It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. A number of states around the country are loosening or attempting to loosen child labor restrictions. Four states have passed laws that roll back limits on teen workers. At least eight more states, including Wisconsin, are considering a variety of laws that would make it easier for minors to work longer and later hours or in fields where minors are typically barred, such as construction and logging. Similar legislation has been put forward on the federal level. We're taking a look at loosening child labor laws around the country, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think teenagers should be able to work longer, later hours with or without parental permission? Do you think teens should be allowed to work in more hazardous occupations like construction? Wisconsin bill on the table would allow teens as young as 14 to serve alcohol at restaurants. What are your thoughts on that? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. John Fleiter is an associate professor of political science at Kansas State University and author of the book Child Labor in America, The Epic Legal Struggle to Protect Children. He recently wrote an article on the topic in The Conversation. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob, for inviting me.
John, before we dig into some particular changes in states around the country, what do you see driving this move in so many different states to change these child labor laws?
Well, I think there are a number of explanations. It's not just relatively recent that we've seen attempts to weaken child labor laws. The movement kind of begins in the 80s and 90s with the Reagan administration and the Bush administration. That would be George H.W. Bush, with, you know, attempts to kind of weaken the laws that were in place. They weren't very successful. But around the turn of the century, early 2000s, you know, we start seeing a more, I think, organized effort by conservative think tanks and libertarian think tanks to kind of challenge labor laws, which have been on the books for about 100 years, and, you know, and certainly in states, and then a little bit more recent in under federal law since 1938. There's that. It's not just a relatively new development. It's been going on for a couple of decades now. And I think another kind of force that's promoting this is, you know, the tight labor market. Conservatives, libertarians are kind of using this situation to kind of weaken child labor laws, you know, allow children to work jobs and maybe fill some of these positions. And you also see that kind of connected to the parental rights movement, where the rationale for weakening some of the laws is tied to, like, let's get the government out of the business of telling, you know, parents whether their kids could work or not, and let parents make that decision. So it's a movement that's been going on for some time, but we have, you know, a situation now where, you know, groups and certain officials are taking advantage of that and trying to weaken those laws.
Let's get into the states that have made changes. Now, four states, Arkansas, Iowa, New Jersey, New Hampshire, which law changes that have actually passed do you have, are you paying most attention to? That you have the most maybe concerns about?
Well, I'm concerned about Arkansas for one, because they eliminated the parental consent form for minors to work. That would be, you know, 16 and under, sorry, 15 and under, you know, to work. They'd have to get a permit signed by their parents. And federal law doesn't actually require that, but most states do have parental, you know, consent forms that act as a check on making sure that, you know, parents are monitoring when their children are working, where they're working, what the conditions are in terms of these jobs. And Arkansas eliminated that requirement under the rationale that they want to give parents more freedom, more rights in determining whether their kids could work. The irony there, or at least I think the hypocrisy, is that it actually undermines parental rights, because it eliminates, you know, the role that the parents play in giving consent on whether their children or their child will work. And it allows for more exploitation to take place in terms of employers who might want to work kids in longer hours and in more dangerous positions.
And talk about the changes being made to those limits on the number of hours, the lateness of hours. What kind of changes are we seeing either passed in states or proposed in states?
Yes, under federal law, minors can work, and we're talking about, 17 and under, they can work during school hours when school is in session, but not past 7 p.m. So a couple of states have passed laws that allow minors to work until 9 o'clock at night, and that's in direct conflict with federal law. So there's actually a bill that's been introduced in Congress to change that and expand the federal regulation from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. That has not been passed and is not likely to pass in our divided Congress. So, that's kind of one direct challenge to federal regulations, federal child labor regulations, is expanding the number of hours that minors could work when school is in session. The argument against, having them work longer hours is that they get tired. They don't perform as well in school. It can undermine their academic performance. And, it might encourage some of them to drop out of school.
We're talking to John Fleiter, Associate Professor of Political Science at Kansas State University, looking at child labor laws in the United States. A handful of states around the country have passed changes, rolling back current protections. Other states have proposals in the works. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Do you want some of these child labor standards rolled back a little bit? What concerns do you have about that idea? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Willem and Colfax, John, called in and mentioned a story he's seen in Wisconsin here. You may have seen it as well. A sawmill operator, Florence Hardwoods, investigated by the Labor Department after the death of a 16-year-old who was working there. This was just this last summer. We also saw violations at a company that did cleaning at meat packing facilities. That was also a story here in Wisconsin. Now, these were in violation of existing laws, which brings me to another big part of the story, enforcement. For the laws that states, the federal government have on the works, how strong an enforcement system do we have?
That's a good question. Under federal regulations, 16 and 17-year-olds are prohibited from working. Well, all minors, but 16 and 17-year-olds generally have a little more flexibility in the types of jobs that they can work, but they cannot work in hazardous occupations, as identified by the Secretary of Labor. And in non-farm employment, there are 18 HOs, or hazardous occupations. And, working in a sawmill is one of those. And in agricultural employment, there are 11 HOs. When it comes to enforcement, that's been, a major challenge. The Department of Labor, over the past 10 years, has lost staff and attorneys. There are fewer regulators to monitor and enforce what's going on in some of these companies. So, that's one problem. Also, the fines don't seem to be enough to deter some of these companies from, illegally hiring, children as employees. Currently, the fine is just over $15,000 per child labor violation. And there are some bills introduced in Congress right now to increase that tenfold, to at least $150,000. So, if those pass, if that, that type of legislation passes, that would, I think, provide more effective enforcement, at least maybe a more effective deterrent in employing some children in some of these more dangerous, hazardous occupations.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. David is with us in Phillips. David, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. I understood that children who work for a family business, like a business your father or mother owns, the laws don't apply to those children. And so I wonder if there's any data about, the history of how those kids do that are allowed to work in a family business. First of all, is that correct? And then secondly, what's the history of their matriculation through school or whatever.
David, thanks for the law. John, does the law treat that family business differently, where if you're working for your folks, the limits may not apply?
That's true in some situations. They still cannot work in the, you know, the hazardous occupations that are off limits to anyone 17 and under. There is a little bit more flexibility in other types of jobs, and certainly in agricultural positions. That's one of the areas where federal law isn't as, you know, extensively, it doesn't extensively regulate those situations. And in fact, there's been a bill introduced for the past 20 years. And I think it's been introduced at least 10 times to tighten some of the federal regulations where children are working on mostly agricultural farms. When we're talking about family-owned farms, there is some flexibility there. I don't have statistics on mm-hmm. how often children in those situations are injured on the job, or to what extent they do not do well in school or drop out of school.
David, thanks a lot for calling in. We're talking to Kansas State University political scientist John Fleiter about why states, including Wisconsin, have put forward proposals to relax child labor protections. Four states have passed some rollbacks. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Why do you think we're seeing a push to loosen child labor protections these days? What are your thoughts on the argument that loosening child labor laws could help with labor shortages as a parent or maybe a young person yourself? What do you think of the laws as they exist now? Do you want to have more hours available to work for kids, later hours, a wider variety of jobs, even though they might be hazardous in some way or another? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation about a number of states' decisions to loosen up some child labor laws. Our guest is John Fleiter, Associate Professor of Political Science at Kansas State University. He co-wrote a piece on the topic at The Conversation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think teens should have more leeway when it comes to working? Employers more leeway to hire them? Have more hours, wider variety of jobs? What worries do you have? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Kelsey is with us from Iowa here in Wisconsin today. Kelsey, hello.
Hi there. Thanks for having my call.
What did you want to bring up, Kelsey?
Well, one of the things that we send down here in Iowa is that because parents' salaries aren't keeping up with inflation and the rising cost in the economy, giving the children or the youth, rather, the opportunity to go and give a job is supplementing the kids' income. So instead of them being able to come to their parents and say, hey, can I have $20 to go to the movie? The parents don't have that. This gives them the opportunity to go and get that. Now, while I'll agree with the idea behind that and making sure that they still have the opportunity to learn financial independence, the problem that we ran into with our own higher teen children was that if they went out and found that job, even as parents, if we try to put some of those restrictions on to say, yeah, they're not going to be working until like 9 or 10 o'clock at night, the businesses would really be like, well, listen, it's all or nothing. If we're going to hire them on, it's going to be in this role, or we can't hire them. So that was one of the challenges that we ran into. Are you seeing any of that, John, or do you know if any of the data is being collected on why parents want to send their kids out to get a job?
Kelsey, thanks a lot for the call. John, Kelsey, seeing some pros and cons here. What do you think?
Well, it's a good point. And what's interesting about some of the laws is that they don't appear to be really driven by parents, you know, putting pressure on state legislatures saying, you know, well, we need more flexibility in whether our kids can work, you know, after school in certain jobs. A lot of the impetus of this legislation is coming from conservative think tanks. There's one down in Florida that is behind a number of these laws, and they have lobbying arms. You know, they're helping the officials in the state legislatures draft the laws and then helping them get the laws passed. So it doesn't seem to be a more of a grassroots movement where parents are saying to state legislators or governors, hey, you know, we want our kids to work longer hours or, you know, at different jobs. It does seem to be more of an interest group kind of instigated movement to just kind of weaken government regulations, covering child labor. I think parents are going to have to decide, like what Arkansas did in removing the parental consent form. You know, parents have to decide if this is good for their kids. You know, I think they've got to balance the need to be in school and stay in school and do well versus earning some extra money, you know, working at a fast food restaurant extra hours. So,
Kelsey, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Mike joins us now in Madison. Mike, hello.
Hello. Well, I take a look at the demographics of the U.S., and it shows with the big retirement of the baby boomers, a hole left where employers need to fill that. And I think what they're trying to do, in my opinion, is to backfill that void with lower-paid younger workers, which has the result of really suppressing the wages. But also, in my opinion, if they were to simply pay higher wages, they could entice some of the earlier, the younger baby boomers to come back out of retirement and to fill that void that exists. So I see this as a organized effort by the business trade unions, trade organizations that maybe they're trying to suppress wages and not have to pay as much to get people back into these roles.
Mike, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. And John, I understand from your piece, I mean, this has been a concern since child labor laws started, that bringing younger workers in was a way to keep wages down.
Oh, yes. In fact, that's why labor unions lobbied against, child labor exploitation, because they understood that it took jobs away from, adult workers, and that it depressed wages. Because in the market, especially, during the period where the child labor issue was most prominent, because it was a policy issue in the United States for about 100 years, roughly from just before the Civil War until the 1930s, when Congress finally passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, 1938, women were always paid less than men and children were paid less than women. So if you want to reduce labor costs, you hired children and you paid them as little as possible. And it's always, been a problem in terms of depressing wages.
Thanks a lot for that call. Thanks a lot for that call, Sarah. Cammie joins us now in Ladysmith. Cammie, hi.
So my question centers around, we have the 7 p.m. for the evening hours on a school day, but what about the start time, such as 5 a.m. in the morning for someone that has to prepare foods?
Cammie, have you run into that with one of your kids or somebody you know, or are you just curious about the start time?
No, we get several people that request they could come in before school starts to work as well.
Now, I have a write-up of the Wisconsin laws in front of me. It looks like here can't work, at least on a school day, can't start earlier than 7 a.m. here in Wisconsin. John, is this a common issue, concerns about not the how late they can work, but how early they can work on a school day?
Yes, there are, there are restrictions on the start of work, and that can vary a little bit from state to state. 7 a.m. in Wisconsin.
All right. Thanks for the call.
That's because that can be just as much of an impact on their education as working late at night, is getting up too early.
John, thanks a lot for that call. John, I want to talk about the future here a little. In that piece I mentioned in the conversation, you and your co-author point out that some of these laws, and particularly those in Iowa, appear to run afoul of federal law. So what are you watching for next on that?
Well, something has to give because, you know, under the Constitution and the Supremacy Clause, federal law is supreme. When state law conflicts with federal law, you know, federal law is supposed to override and trump what the states are doing. The thing about child labor regulations, though, is that, you know, it's a mix of both federal law and state law. Some in some areas, you know, federal law is kind of weak. It doesn't cover or require the fact that, you know, parents should have a consent form signed to allow their kid to work. That's something that the states require because it's believed to be a good thing, you know, to have that little check where, you know, parents can at least say that they want to allow their child to work, you know, at a certain place, for certain hours. So there are some loopholes in some areas where federal law does not reach, and that's where the states step in. And for, you know, most of our history, the states maintain pretty decent child labor laws. But, you know, recently we're seeing kind of this push to weaken them, which I think is concerning.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today. That was John Fleiter, Associate Professor of Political Science at Kansas State University. He talked to us about his recent piece in The Conversation about efforts to loosen up child labor laws in states around the country. A related question for you. Love to hear about your first job, your memories of working maybe as a teen yourself, hopefully within the bounds of the law. Tell us about it. Email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. We get a couple stories. We could share them next week here on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Think back to what you had for lunch today. How much did you enjoy it? Maybe you went out to a restaurant because it's Friday. But for a lot of us, the workday lunch is a bring-your-own kind of meal. It's Food Friday, and if you're like me, the lunch you pack is often something like a cold sandwich or maybe some reheated leftovers. It can get kind of boring. And with school back in session, if you pack lunches for your kids, it can be hard to keep coming up with fresh, tasty ideas that are also healthy. Our next guest is here to help us step up our lunch game to pack meals for ourselves or our children that look better, taste better, and are better for us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you pack for lunch for yourself or your children? Are you ever at a loss, especially if you didn't remember to pack something the night before? That happened to me sometimes. What ways have you found to make your own packed lunches more interesting? And do you have memories of bringing that lunch to school? Trading with your friends? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Aviva Wittenberg is author of the cookbook Lunchbox, 75 plus easy and delicious recipes for lunches on the go. Aviva, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
What got you so fired up about upping our packed lunch games?
Oh, do you know, I stumbled into writing Lunchbox and into sharing lunches when my kids were little and really wanted Instagram accounts. And so the deal was if they got an Instagram account, I would have one too, and I would follow them. And at that point, I felt compelled to post something. So I posted their lunches every day and found a whole wonderful community of other parents who are packing lunches and sharing them. So I've been doing that for about a decade. Published a book in Canada last summer that you described called Lunchbox that will be coming out in the spring in the U.S. And have been, now that my kids are big, sharing my own lunches and my back-to-work lunches.
Now, I got to say, for me, lunches, I think, are always an afterthought. Yeah, I'll take whatever. And for the kids, like, I tried sometimes successfully, sometimes not. Give us a pep talk on the value of taking that packed lunch seriously as something that can be fun and interesting.
So I think lunch packing is a pain point for everyone, right? It's it's like a task you have to do, and for some reason, it's like never as exciting as making dinner. And so one of the things I do is I make a plan for a few days or for a week at a time, and then I spend a little bit of time preparing. Maybe on a Sunday, making a few components so that making a lunch, like the process is really quick. And I can just sort of, I don't need to think about it first thing in the morning. I can throw what I need to in a bento box and send my kids out the door. So that is a big part of it. And for my kids, when involving them in planning makes them a little bit more excited about lunch and maybe excited, even more excited about the day ahead, and sets them up for sets them up for success and learning and fun at school, which is really important, I think, to all parents.
Now, you mentioned that bento box, and looking at pictures in your book, I'm like, where does she get those cool toys? Like, you had amazing serving things in there that I was like, why didn't we have those? Tell us about the gear you have to pack those lunches into.
So hands down, my favorite lunch boxes are made by an American company called Lunchbot. They were designed by a mother who lived and breathed lunch packing, and they're just a stainless steel box. They're definitely not inexpensive, but I can tell you that mine has been a great investment. The lunch boxes pictured in my book are my kids' lunch boxes and are more than a decade old now. So they are a great investment. They really tolerate all kinds of terrible treatment, go in the dishwasher, and are yours for life.
And they have separate compartments in them, right?
Yeah, which is great. And for kids especially, they can open up their lunchbox and they can see everything they've got all at once. And there's only one lid to lose, right? So the odds are that you will get your whole lunchbox back at the end of the day. When my kids took lots of little containers, invariably lids and containers were left behind.
It's Food Friday. We are improving the packed lunch with Aviva Wittenberg, author of the cookbook Lunchbox 75 Plus Easy and Delicious Recipes for Lunches on the Go. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your packed lunch strategy? If you pack for kids, do you work with them to come up with ideas? Do you feel like you get stuck in ruts, as I do? Do the kids get tired of the same things as mine did? I never did. I could eat the same thing all school year, basically, when I was a kid. Most people can't. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's get a taste. You shared a recipe with us from the cookbook. People can find it at WPR.org/Food Friday. Aviva, you gave us this egg, greens, and cheese tortilla. Pretty easy to make, it looks like. Can you talk us through that recipe a little bit?
Yeah, that is a great recipe for lots of reasons. One is that it is so quick to make. It's a great one to whip up first thing in the morning. And it's also a great way to use up those kind of wilting greens. I know I buy like those box salads, and invariably with like the baby spinach, after a couple of days, it looks a bit wilty and doesn't look great for a salad, but it's perfect for this recipe. And basically, you beat up a couple of eggs, pour them in a pan, chop them with a tortilla, some greens, like whatever you've got, and some grated cheese, whatever you've got in the fridge. Great to use up odds and ends of cheese that you might have in your cheese drawer. Let that set up and then roll it up. And for an adult, I would just roll it up as is. For kids, finger food is great, especially when they're little. My kids were not great with cutlery when they were little. It would get lost. And it just like took too long to eat food with cutlery. So I did cut them into little bite-sized pieces for them so they could quickly eat them and then head out to the schoolyard to play.
That's another tip you have in the book that reminds me, you know, think about whether you're talking about kids or yourself, you know, where you're eating it, what kind of time you have, what the situation is, what kind of things do you think about to decide, okay, this is going to be too fussy to eat in this situation?
So this was especially important with my kids. So they just had like a 20-minute window for lunch. And for some years, they could sit and eat at tables. And other years, they sat on the gym floor with a whole bunch of other kids. And so it had to be stuff that was pretty easy to eat. The other thing that I'm always mindful is how you can store your lunch, if you can store your lunch in a fridge or not. My kids never had access to fridges, so we did lots of ice packs, or there's some great lunch bags where the whole lunch bag is an ice pack that you pop in the freezer overnight and then put your lunch bag or box in the morning. For adults, if you know, if you can eat at your desk, whether you work remotely or work in an office, it's a little bit more flexible. But definitely, you know, I'm thinking about whether, you know, where you can safely store your food during the day, if you have a fridge or not, and if you like your food warmed up or not. And so if you have access to a microwave, thinking ahead about packing in a container that's not stainless steel so that you can warm up your food and enjoy it that way.
We are talking about packing great lunches for our kids or ourselves. It's Food Friday. Author Aviva Wittenberg is with us, author of Lunchbox, 75 plus easy and delicious recipes for lunches on the go and how to make our packed lunches less bland or boring. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is this a stressful thing for you, packing that lunch for yourself or especially for your kids? What kind of things go into the lunch box or lunch bag or bento box if you have one of those? Do you have one that your kid just wouldn't eat? What did you do to replace it? Do you have a favorite memory of that packed lunch that you brought to school back in the day? Join in with your experiences, your own advice, or your questions for our guest. The number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up our Food Friday conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We're picking up our talk with Aviva Wittenberg. She's the author of Lunchbox, 75 plus easy and delicious recipes for lunches on the go. And she's with us today to help us level up the lunches we pack for work and or school. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your go-to meals to pack for lunch? What were your kids' favorites to bring to school? Join in at 800-642-1234. What did you maybe pack for the school day today for kids? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Aviva, another strategy you give in the book, I never would have thought of this really for packing lunches, making hand pies, you know, those little pies. Sounds complicated to me, but you say, hold on, those puff pastries you can buy in the store. Tell us how you pull together a good lunch hand pie.
Yeah, so like puff pastry is like the queen of the kitchen and can make almost anything taste better. And it's a great vehicle for any leftovers you have, like stews and sauces and stuff like that. And especially for kids, it's more finger food. They can like gobble down quickly. So there are a bunch of recipes for, you know, sort of versatile things in the book. So like a really rich bolognese sauce that's great on pasta, maybe for dinner, but the next day you can, you know, make extra sauce and fold it into puff pastry, bake it, and then pop it into your lunchbox with a salad or some cut out veggies. So puff pastry is great, not just how I describe it in the book, but in any kind of leftovers that you have.
Brianna Caller at 800-642-1234. Diana's with us in Elkhorn. Diane, hi.
Hi. As part of my son's lunch, I always put an inspiring story in it. I would get Expect a Miracle books or some inspiring story. And I would copy it the night before and I'd stick it in his lunch the next day. And when he quit that job, the people, he would always just leave the story on the lunch table after he was finished eating for the rest of the people. And when he quit that job, they said, "You can't quit. We won't have our stories."
Diane,
so I think in inspiring comments or quotes or something, my daughter leaves little notes for her son every day.
I love it, Diane. Thanks so much for sharing that. Aviva, is this something, do you put in notes or other printed material as part of your lunch project?
Yeah, no, I don't. But you know, my mom, when she used to pack my lunch, we didn't have reusable stuff. We just had like paper bags and, you know, kind of regular stuff. And she used to draw a picture or kind of fun stuff on a lunch bag for me every day that I loved until I was a teenager when it like embarrassed me a bit. But secretly, wow. I loved it. So yeah, that kind of stuff is so powerful and is a nice connection, especially with your kids during the day.
Diane, thanks for sharing that story at 800-642-1234. Raleigh is with us in Oak Creek. Raleigh, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Well, I'm a lifetime brown bagger, or, you know, I always made my own lunches and sandwiches and whatnot. And one of my axioms is any good sandwich starts with good bread. I mean, you know, you can have good bad ingredients, but if the bread's good, it still might be tolerable. But as you know, some breads hold up better than others or not as well. I imagine your guest has some expertise on the best breads to choose that hold up better, you know, during the daytime while you're waiting to eat, or whether the bread is chilled or not, or whether they've used condiments on the bread before eating. Or
Raleigh, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. Aviva, yeah, there's nothing less inspiring than that soggy sandwich. Any advice on keeping that bread as delicious it was as when you made the sandwich?
Oh, I totally agree. And I am so passionate about good bread. There's really nothing better. So I love tomatoes in a sandwich, but they will turn your sandwich bread like soggy in an instant. So I always pack them on the side. If you have other wet ingredients, you can do the same thing, or, you know, try to protect them. So if you're using like meat or cheese, put your wet ingredients in between those sort of barriers to protect your bread. I also toast bread a little bit to help it hold up. And beyond that, I tend to use like heartier breads and stick away from, you know, kind of soft white bread, because I do find it doesn't hold up, especially if you're packing your lunch the night before.
Raleigh, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Aviva, one of your big strategies, and you gave an example of it already with one of your hand pies, is, you know, when you're making dinner, think about how you're going to repurpose it for that packed lunch. What kind of things can we do?
Yeah, and I think that's really important, because you don't want to spend hours and hours in the kitchen every day. We're all pretty busy. So I like to either reimagine dinner into lunch. One of the things I've done with my family, because everyone has different preferences, is we'll do kind of a DIY meal. So we'll do like noodle bowls, and I'll cut up lots and prepare a bunch of different vegetables and different proteins. And the next day for lunch, so for dinner, we'll have a bowl. For lunch, those can be turned into wraps using like rice paper or a tortilla, so that I'm only spending time chopping and preparing once and making dinner and lunch all at once, and saves me an extra step.
Let's bring on another caller now. Vicky is with us in La Crosse. Vicky, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Vicky?
Well, the lunches I had growing up, I am 71, so this is many years ago, and I went to country school even, so no refrigeration, et cetera. But one of the things we took was we had homemade bread, and we'd toast it and butter it and let it get cold and just carry that to school in a bag or whatever. And the other one was bread with butter and brown sugar sandwiches. Delicious to a kid.
Did you have sides with that, Vicky, or was it just the buttered toast and brown sugar?
You know, we weren't into fruit, and I think somehow we had milk, but I don't remember if we got that at school or if we brought it. And then maybe like a cookie, which, of course, wasn't any better than eating brown sugar sandwiches. But
gotcha.
Yeah.
Vicky, thanks a lot for sharing that. I had a lot of peanut butter sandwiches, and that's not that much different than that brown sugar bread. Thanks for the call, Vicky. And Aviva, that reminds me, a big focus that we haven't got into here yet is healthy food. You're trying to have stuff that's at least kind of good for us or our kids when you're packing these lunches.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking, especially when I pack my kids' lunches, of setting them up for, like, learning. But definitely there's a balance. And one of the things that I think is important is that my kids actually eat their lunch. Uh-huh. And so I don't introduce new stuff. You know, anything I pack to them is something that they like. But fruit and vegetables are delicious and can be a great part of a healthy lunchbox. But I try to stay away from labeling food like that, just that it be like nourishing, but really delicious, and something that you can eat with your eyes as well as your mouth.
Talking to Aviva Wittenberg, author of the cookbook Lunchbox, 75 plus easy and delicious recipes for lunches on the go. It's Food Friday. Still time for you to join in with your questions. If you need some inspiration for our guest or lessons you've learned, maybe the hard way when it comes to packing lunches for yourself or others, 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Aviva, another case you make in the book is that, you know, kids will eat, can eat adult food. You don't really have a separate category of kids' food. How do you try to instill that idea with your kids?
So with my kids, we only ever had, you know, like one meal growing up. It was like a family meal, especially with dinner, where, you know, I served things that everyone would like and took everyone's preferences into consideration. But in general, we didn't, you know, we tried to avoid having a separate menu for our kids. And so they just learned to love like food. And we are really lucky to live in Toronto, which is like a really diverse city, and had the pleasure of like exploring the whole world in our city through all of the amazing restaurants that are here. So I'm lucky. My kids are naturally adventurous eaters. And I did all these things, but I think that that's just how they were born. That's not the case for all kids. And so I think it's important for parents who sometimes take that as like a parenting failure. I think we just got really lucky with adventurous, curious eaters. They're not adventurous and curious and always, but they happen to be about food. And so, you know, I think you have to give your kids the food that they like. But there's nothing wrong with introducing a single family meal in a single way of eating.
And Aviva, I mean, you're doing a great job, it looks like, with packing lunches for kids. That said, have you ever struck out where, you know, that one part of the container comes back just as full as when it left, or you find out they traded it at school or something like that?
Oh, yeah, tons of times, of course. Yeah, so, like, tons. I may document all this stuff, but of course, there have been lots of failures, whether it's been my kids taking, so they have some containers that don't seal all the way to the bottom, and they took sushi and fruit one day to school, and they poured soy sauce on their sushi, and the soy sauce leaked out across the bottom.
No.
And ruined their fruit. And for days and days, maybe weeks, I heard about how I had ruined lunch. And then there are other days where they just like wanted to get busy in the schoolyard or were chatting with their friends and just didn't eat lunch. So I think it's just important to not take it personally. You know, they ate. And all of this is big picture, right? If they don't eat vegetables for a week or a month and only want to eat fruit over the course of their lives, they'll be fine. Those are just like small windows.
All right, Aviva, we've talked mostly about kids here. What is your favorite thing? You're probably packing your own, but what is your favorite thing? It's probably not a surprise. Would you open up the lunchbox and you packed it for yourself?
Well, so funny enough, I've been working remotely for the last little while, and I'm going back into the office next week. So this is like top of mind. This whole time that I've been working remotely, I've been employing the same strategies because I still only have, you know, like a short lunch break. And can't disappear for hours from my computer to go, like, make lunch. So I still prep stuff in advance. Far and away, especially at this time of the year, I love, like, salads and kind of grain bowls because the produce is so nice. So I'm thinking ahead to next week. Stone fruit is especially delicious right now. So I think when I go back on Wednesday, I'll pack myself, like, a summer fruit caprese salad. So some, like, peaches and plums that I'll section. Add some fresh mozzarella and a bed of arugula. And watermelon is also amazing, amazing right now. So I have a great recipe for a watermelon and grilled halloumi salad with like kind of a chimichurri dressing that I think I will have on Friday. So stuff like that. I really like to eat with the seasons because that's when stuff tastes best.
Aviva, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. It was fun to speak with you.
That was Aviva Wittenberg, author of the cookbook Lunchbox, 75 plus easy and delicious recipes for lunches on the go. She was with us today on Food Friday to share her advice and recipes for packing lunches that are fun, tasty, and healthy. And I guess most important, not boring. You can find one of the recipes from that book. She shared it with us at WPR.org/Food Friday. Really easy, and a good twist on kind of a wrap and an omelet. It's an egg, greens, and cheese tortilla. Find it online at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let us know how it works out in your lunchbox next week. coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Get some more great food advice for when you're cooking for guests and for gatherings. Kate will talk to the author of the book, Company, The Radically Casual Art of Cooking for Others. You can join the conversation, maybe with your own advice. That's Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. As a kid and as a grown-up, I was always happy with some leftover pizza in my lunch. But what style of pizza? A new analysis from the Department of Data at the Washington Post uses online reviews to try to figure out the favorite pizza style in every state. No surprise, New York-style pizza, number one choice in most states, but Wisconsin, our number one is the category known as Neapolitan-ish. The Post defines that as, quote, thin crust pies that are fired in minutes in blast furnace-like ovens. Now, the data may be a little off, I think. Like, when are you going to be motivated to post an online review of a pizza? Probably when you go to the place with the fancy pizza oven. A lot of pizzas here in the state are eaten at bars, heated up in those little electric pizza ovens. The favorite kind is whatever kind they got, frozen. Are you going to review that online? I used to order those a lot when I played in a bar near my house when we had two or three songs left in the set. Put in my order over the microphone, be ready just in time for the set break. It's great, but I was never motivated to write that review. This is Central Time.